Min asked. Have you ever stayed at the Island Dog? No, but it's nice. You'll like it, I said, having to raise my voice over the boat engine. A two-story pale blue house with white hurricane shutters, it was the only B&B on the island. I wondered if Bonnie Langston still owned it. She was what Hepzibah called a Cumya, gullah for somebody who comes from another place. If your ancestry was on the island, then you were a Binya. Cumyas were rare on Egret, but they did exist. My sole purpose after the age of 10 had been to leave the island. I want to be a Goya, I told Hepzibah once, and at first she'd laughed, but then stopped and looked at me, down into the heartsick place that made me want to leave. You can't leave home, she said with her gentlest voice. You can go other places, all right. You can live on the other side of the world, but you can't ever leave home. I felt now I'd proved her wrong. Be sure to eat at Max's Cafe, I told the tourist. Order the shrimp and grits. Actually, if he wanted to eat, the cafe was his only choice. Like the B&B, it had been named for Max, the black lab whose mind Benny could supposedly read. He met the ferry twice a day without fail, and was something of a local celebrity. In warm weather, when the tables spilled out onto the sidewalk, he would trot around with an acquired sense of canine entitlement, giving mere human beings the opportunity to adore him. They would scramble for their cameras as if Lassie had come onto the set. He was famous not only for meeting the fairy with uncanny accuracy, but for his immortality. Purportedly, he was 27 years old. Bonnie swore to it, but the truth was, the current Max was the fourth in a string of them. I'd been loving various Maxes since I was a kid. There was a sand beach on the front of the island called Boneyard, so named because driftwood formed huge contorted sculptures along it. Hardly anyone ventured there, though, because the currents made it too dangerous for swimming, and it was full of sand gnats. You only had to stand there to know that the ocean would take the island back one day. Most of the tourists came for the guided tour of the monastery, St. Sanara's Abbey. It was named for a Celtic saint who'd been a mermaid before her conversion, and it had started as a simple outpost, or as the monk said, a daughter house, of an abbey in Cornwall, England. The monks had built it themselves in the 30s on land donated by a Catholic family from Baltimore, who'd used it for a summer fishing camp. In the beginning, the place was so unpopular that Egret Islanders, all of them Protestants, called it Saint Sin. Now, Protestants were more or less extinct here. The local guidebooks played up the monastery as a minor low-country attraction, mostly because of the mermaid chair that sat in a side chapel in the church. A beguiling chair, the books always said. And it was, actually. It was a replica of a very old, somewhat famous chair in the abbey's mother house. The arms had been carved into two winged mermaids, painted with jeweled colors, vermilion fishtails, white wings, golden orange hair. As children, Mike and I used to slip into the church when no one was about, lured, of course, by the titillation of the nipples on the mermaid's exposed breasts, four shining inlaid garnet stones. I used to give Mike a hard time about sitting with his hands cupped around them. The memory of this caused me to laugh, and I looked up to see if the other passengers had noticed. If the tourists were lucky and the chapel wasn't roped off, they could sit in the mermaid chair themselves and say a prayer to Sanara, the mermaid saint. For some reason, sitting in it was supposed to guarantee you an answer. At least that was the tradition. Mostly the whole thing came off like throwing pennies into a fountain and making wishes. But now and then you would see a real pilgrim, someone in a wheelchair rolling off the ferry, or someone with a small oxygen tank. The ferry moved slowly through the salt creeks, past tiny marsh islands waving with yellowed spartina grass. The tide had ebbed, laying bare miles of oyster rakes. Everything looked undressed, exposed. As the creeks widened out into the bay, we picked up speed. Vs of brown pelicans lapped alongside us, outpacing the boat. I focused on them and, when they'd vanished, on the lifelines hanging in sloppy coils inside the ferry. I didn't want to think about my mother. On the plane, I'd been saturated with dread. But out here, that lifted some, maybe because of all the wind and freedom. I tilted my head back against the window and breathed the marsh's sulfurous smell. The boat captain, in his faded red cap and wraparound metallic sunglasses, began to speak into a microphone. His voice coasted through the little speaker over my head in a memorized oration designed for tourists. He told them where to rent the golf carts that would take them around the island, gave them a little spiel about the egret rookery and fishing charters. He closed with the same joke I'd heard the last time I'd come. "Folks, just remember there are alligators on the island. I doubt you'll see one this time of year, but if you do, keep in mind that you can't outrun an alligator. Just be sure you can outrun whoever you're with." The tourists chuckled and nodded at one another, the whole business of venturing onto a Carolina barrier island suddenly thrust into a new and slightly dangerous light. As the ferry slipped into the narrow waterways, interlacing the marsh on the island's backside, I got up and walked out onto the deck. Swells of water glided past, the color of darkly steeped tea. Looking back at the wake at the distance we'd covered, I realized how isolated I'd been growing up on an island without a bridge. I'd been thoroughly caged in by water. And yet, I'd never felt lonely until I'd started high school on the mainland. I remembered Shem Watkins taking all of us kids, probably fewer than half a dozen of us, across Bull's Bay each morning in his shrimp boat, then picking us up in the afternoon. We'd called it the shrimp bus. Mike and I had imagined ourselves like the Swiss Family Robinson, he rowing his bateau through the creeks, stopping to bog for fiddler crabs, which we'd sold for bait at 50 cents a pound on the ferry dock. We'd known every channel and sandbar, exactly where the shell rakes might snag the boat's bottom during low tide. The summer I was 9, before everything collapsed, we'd been dauntless, scavenging for turkey tracks and alligator drags. At night, with the palmettos rattling wildly around the house, we'd slipped out through the window and gone to the slave cemetery, where we'd double and triple dog dared the ghosts to come out. Where had that girl gone? Staring into the tannic-looking waters, I felt a terrible craving for her. I was surprised by the weight of memory, the awful contagion of family, of place. I remembered my father steering his 20-foot Chris-craft, the meerschaum pipe I'd bought him clamped between his teeth, and me tucked between his chest and the wheel. I could almost hear him calling, "Jesse, the dolphins are here!" See myself racing for the rail, listening for their breath to spew, the slit of darkness as they broke the surface. When the northwest side of the island came into view, I was already thinking about his boat exploding, about the clipping in Mother's drawer. Police speculate that a spark from his pipe may have ignited a leak in the fuel line. I let my eyes sweep over the water, remembering where it happened, then looked away. I walked the length of the ferry rail and watched the island draw closer. It was only 5 miles long and 2.5 across, but it seemed even smaller from the boat. The rooftops of the shops behind the ferry dock came into view, laughing gulls looping over them. And beyond that, the live oak, palm, and myrtle thickets that filled the green heart of the island. The engine throttled down as the pontoon approached the dock. Someone threw a rope, and I heard the creaking of old wood as we were hitched tightly against the pilings. On the pier, a few people in beach chairs dangled rods over the side, fishing for channel bass. but no Cat and Benny. Cat had promised they would meet me. I went back inside the boat, collected my suitcase, then stood at the window as the other passengers debarked. A few moments later, they came hurrying up with Max trotting behind them. They were holding hands, and Benny appeared to be half-dragging Cat, who was wearing her high heels with the thin socks. Her hair was pulled up into a dark red topknot, a color my mother referred to as port wine. Pieces of it were starting to unravel around her face. They stopped at the edge of the dock and looked up at the boat. Max sat between them, wagging half of his tail as if it were jointed. When Cat spotted me at the window, her chest rose visibly.
"Well, don't just stand up there. Come on down here," she yelled.
Benny sprang into a funny jig, lifting her feet and marching in place.
"Jesse! Jesse!" she chanted,
and Max started to bark, which created an eruption of gulls along the edge of the dock. The other passengers paused to stare, then glanced at one another, embarrassed. Home. There was nothing to do but collect my suitcase and wade into it. There were half-moons like pale yellowish shadows under Cat's eyes. She embraced me at the same moment the aroma of the island penetrated. A powerful brew of silt, old crab pots, salted air, and black, gooey mudflats, alive and crawling with pungent creatures.
"You made it," Cat said,
and I smiled at her. Benny laid her round face against the sleeve of my coat and clung to me like a barnacle. I put my arm around her and gave her a squeeze.
"You didn't want to come," she said. "You hate coming here."
Cat cleared her throat.
"All right, Benny, that's enough."
Benny was not finished, however.
"Mama is standing on the bloodstain," she said.
I looked down. We all did. The dark, spattered edge of it was visible beneath Cat's shoe. I pictured the frenzied dash they must have made to the ferry dock, the ride across the water, Mother's hand wrapped in a JCPenney bath towel. Cat slid back her foot, and we stood in the late afternoon, in a moment of perfect stillness, and stared at my mother's blood. Chapter 5. We piled onto Cat's golf cart, parked at the end of the pier. Benny sat on the back with my suitcase, and I climbed into the front seat, glancing warily at the air horn, thinking of the last harrowing ride in her cart.
"Don't worry," Cat said. "I won't use the horn unless someone is crazy enough to step out in front of me."
"I hate that odious thing," I said.
"Yes, well, hate it all you want, but it has saved the lives of countless tourists." "Mama used to aim for tourists," Betty said. "Oh, I did not."
"I believe it's impossible for Benny to tell a lie," I said, and Cat huffed as she pulled onto the narrow pavement. Overhead, the sky was turning orange. I had the sense of darkness pressing in, pooling behind the brightness. As we swept past the island shops, no one spoke, not even Benny. The storefronts all had window boxes gorged with lavender pansies, even the tiny post office. Shem's bait and tackle had been painted the color of persimmons, and the carved wooden pelican outside Caw Caw General Store now wore a pony saddle, I imagined so that children could sit on it. We passed a handful of tourists in front of Egret Expeditions, signing up for boat tours and bird walks. Even at the nadir of winter, the place seemed alive. I pointed to a small store wedged between Max's Cafe and the Island Dog B&B. It had a blue and white striped awning and a sign in the window that read, "The Mermaid's Tale."
"Didn't that used to be a fish market?" "It went out of business," Cat said. "That's Mama's store now," said Benny.
"No kidding. You own it? That gift shop?" I was surprised. I'd known Cat my whole life,
and she'd never shown the least interest in shopkeeping. After her husband died, which had to be 20 years ago at least, she and Benny had lived contentedly off his pension and a little Social Security.
"I opened it last spring," Cat said.
"Who's minding the store right now?"
"When I'm there, it's open. When I'm not, it's closed," she said.
"I like the name," I told her.
"I wanted to call it Femme Fatale, but your mother nixed that. The woman has no sense of humor."
"She never did."
"That's not true. Once upon a time, she had a great sense of humor," Cat said.
She lit out down the road, heading into the tinted light. I watched her lean forward as if she were willing the cart to surpass the 18-mile-per-hour speed limit, and so many things swam up to me. Scraps of my mother's laughter, times when we were still normal and happy. Cat was right. Mother had possessed a great sense of humor once. I thought of the time she made coconut shrimp and served it wearing a hula skirt. That time Mike was 8 and got his poor penis stuck in a Coke bottle while urinating into it, for reasons none of us ever understood. His penis had, shall we say, expanded somewhat after entry. Mother had tried to act concerned, but broke down laughing. She told him,
"Mike, go sit in your room and picture Mother Teresa, and your penis will come right out."
"The biggest sellers in the shop are yellow signs that say Mermaid Crossing," Cat was telling me. "Plus our mermaid booklets. You remember Father Dominic? He wrote up the story of St. Sonara for us, and we got it printed in a little booklet titled The Mermaid's Tale. Same name as the store. We can't keep them in stock. Dominic is always coming in, wearing that damn fool hat of his, wanting to autograph copies. I tell him, 'For God's sake, Dominic, it's not like you're Pat Conroy.'"
I laughed. As a child, I'd often bumped into Father Dominic as I played on the monastery grounds, waiting for Mother to finish in the kitchen. He'd always told me knock-knock jokes. But there had been another side to him, something somber I couldn't quite put my finger on. He had been one of the monks who'd come to the house that day bearing the remains of my father's boat, who'd stood there as Mother burned the boards in the fireplace. "He still wears the straw hat?"
"Same one. The straw is starting to rot," she said.
We lapsed into silence as we skirted the back edge of the island, most of it an undeveloped tangle of wind-pruned trees. We came around a curve where the trees opened onto a prairie of caramel grasses, and beyond it, the ocean. The water was inking into purple, and something about this brought everything back. The reason I was here, what Mother had done with the cleaver. Her life had gotten so twisted and confused. I wondered if I'd been a better daughter, whether any of this would have happened. Shouldn't I have seen it coming? As far as I knew, she could be home at this very moment, lopping off the rest of her fingers. Why her finger, I thought. Why that? Benny was singing to herself on the back seat. I leaned over to Cat. "What happened to her finger, the one she cut off?"
"It's in a mayonnaise jar by her bed," she answered matter-of-factly.
The spire of the Abbey Church came into view just as the paved road ran out. Cat didn't bother to slow down, and we bounced a foot in the air as we came onto the hard-caked dirt. Clouds of dust roiled up.
"Hold on," she shouted to Benny.
Cat's hair flew completely out of its bobby pins and fluttered behind her as we sailed by the monastery gate. Just past it sat the Star of the Sea Chapel, the white-clabbered parish church where the monks said mass for the islanders, and where all Egret Island children, including me, had attended grammar school. Every grade had been simultaneously taught by Anna Laguerre, who'd told me point-blank when I was 10 that I was a born artist. She'd hung my endless sketches of boat wrecks on the chapel wall when I was 11 and invited the whole island to the show. Cat had bought one for a quarter. "Whatever happened to that picture of mine you bought and hung in your kitchen?"
"I still have it. It's hanging in the mermaid's tail now,"
As we passed her driveway, I noticed the Mermaid Crossing sign nailed to a post beside the mailbox. A few seconds later, we slowed in front of Mother's house, built in the style of an 1820s tidewater cottage, like most of the island homes. It stood on stilts in a forest of palmetto palms, with dormers and black shutters and a wide veranda that stretched across the front. The house had always been some lush shade of green, but at the moment, it was washed out aqua. The yard was infested with yucca bristle and dollarweed, and standing in the middle of it was Mother's appalling bathtub grotto. Over a decade ago, she'd enlisted Shem to bury an upright bathtub halfway into the ground, and being slow to grasp the point, he'd left the end of the tub with the faucets on it exposed. Mother had gone ahead anyway and placed a concrete statue of Mary inside the porcelain arch. Now the tub had splotches of rust and some sort of plastic flower wired to the spigot. The first time I saw the tub, I told Mother that all those tears Mary's statues reportedly cried were because of the extreme tackiness of her devotees. Dee, naturally, had thought the bathtub Madonna was awesome. As we rode to a stop and Benny leaped off the back, I saw Hepzibah standing on the porch. She wore one of her African outfits, a batik shift in scarlet and saffron colors that came to her ankles, and a matching cloth coiled around her head. She looked tall and resplendent standing there. "Well, if it isn't a Hottentot queen," said Cat, waving to her. She laid her hand on my arm. "Jessie, if your mother says fish fly, just nod and say, 'Yes, ma'am, fish fly.' Don't argue with her about anything, all right?" "Some fish can fly," said Benny. "I saw a picture in a book." Cat ignored her. She kept her eyes on my face. "Don't upset her." I pulled away. "I'm not planning on upsetting anybody." Hepzibah met me halfway on the porch steps, trailing the aroma of okra gumbo, and I knew she'd made us dinner. "We glad for see you na," she said, lapsing into Gullah the way she used to whenever she greeted me. I smiled, looked past her at the window lit from within. I stared at the wooden frame, how it was splintering a little, at a little smear glowing on the pane. And tears came, just enough so I couldn't hide them. "Now, what's this about?" said Hepzibah, and she pulled me into the dizzying designs on her dress. I stepped back from her. It struck me as a ludicrous question. I might have said, "Well, for starters, there's a mayonnaise jar in the house with my mother's finger inside it." But that would have been rude and undeserved. And besides, it wasn't my mother I was thinking about. It was my father. The last time I'd seen Joseph Dubois, he'd been sitting at that window, peeling an apple without breaking the skin. A minor stunt in his renowned repertoire of tricks. He was making a whirligirl. I'd sat on the floor that night in a puddle of lamplight and watched the irresistible way the peel had spun off the blade of his knife, nervous over whether he would make it all the way to the end without breaking it. I'd risen up on my knees as he'd come to the last turn. If he made it, I would get to hang the red spiral in my bedroom window with the other whirligirls he'd created, all of them suspended by sewing thread, bobbing at the glass pane in various stages of puckered decay. "A whirligirl for my whirligirl," he'd said, calling me by his pet name and dropping it into my open palms. Those were his last words to me. I dashed to my room without looking back, without letting him know that what I loved best about this ritual was the part where he called me his whirligirl. How I imagined myself one of his perfect creations. The apple skins in my window, a strange still frame of self-portraits. Seeing my tears, Cat clattered up the steps in her heels and hovered over me with her arms flapping around her sides. She reminded me of a clapper rail, one of the noisiest birds in the marsh, a big hen of a bird, and I felt my anger at her melt before she spoke.
Jessie, I talk too much and can't keep my damn foot out of my mouth. Of course you wouldn't go in there and upset your mother.
It's okay, I said. It wasn't that, really. Benny plodded up the steps, lugging my suitcase. She set it at the door. I thanked them all and said they could go, that I would be fine. I said the tears were because I was tired, that's all. They drove away in the golf cart, lumbering over a series of tree roots. Island speed bumps, Cat called them. I told myself I should go inside, but I stood on the porch for a few minutes in a breeze that had chilled and darkened and smelled of the marsh, finishing whatever had come over me earlier. That little baptism of sadness.
Chapter 6. Brother Thomas. He lay prostrate on the floor of the church with his arms stretched out on either side in the shape of the cross. Punishment for the things he'd written in a small, leather-bound notebook. Father Sebastian, the prior at the monastery, had found it on the counter inside the abbey gift shop, where he'd left it for a few moments while he'd pointed a tourist to the restrooms at the rear of the store, then answered questions from another about the cast nets that were for sale in the shop. How long had the monks been making them? Had they learned the art from the islanders, or had they brought it with them from Cornwall? Did they really sell enough of them to support the monastery? He wished now he hadn't taken so much time with the man. It was February, Ash Wednesday, and the floor felt cold, even a little damp through his black robe. He lay in the aisle between the choir stalls, which stood on either side of the nave facing each other, and listened as the monks sang evening prayer. Brother Timothy was crooning like a lounge singer. O loving, O sweet Virgin Mary. When they finished the Salve Regina, he heard the hinged seats built into each stall squeak as they were lifted, then a tired shuffling of feet as the monks lined up to be sprinkled with holy water by the abbot. Finally, the lights went out, except for the one near the abbot's stall, and Brother Thomas was left in the near dark, in a luxuriant silence. He was the youngest monk at 44, and also the newest, a so-called junior monk with temporary vows. His solemn vows, usque ad mortem, until death, were only 4 months away. What had he been thinking, giving a lecture to the man in the gift shop as if he'd been here half his life? He'd gone on and on about the cast nets. He lay there and cursed himself. It had given Father Sebastian, who really should have been a marine and not a monk, an opportunity to thumb through his notebook and grow alarmed for the state of his soul. He'd taken it to the abbot, who was very old school about things and thoroughly Irish. Thomas had been summoned to his office, into the dreaded papal enclosure, as he sometimes thought of it. Now, here he was, on the floor. He'd been lectured by the abbot a dozen times at least, but this was the first time he'd been punished, and it didn't seem so bad, really, lying here. He would stay until the abbot felt he'd meditated long enough on the perils of doubt and sent someone to release him. He'd been here like this an hour, perhaps longer. The floor of the church smelled of Murphy's oil soap and something else sour and slightly manure-ish that he realized was a mixture of pluff mud from the marsh and fertilizer from the garden. It was clogged and hardened into microscopic crevices in the wooden boards, having been tracked in on the monk's shoes for the last 50 years. Here, in this rarefied place, where they all imagined themselves marinating in holiness through their ceaseless rounds of chanting and prayer, was all this hidden mud and cow shit. It was hard to overestimate how much this pleased him. Brother Thomas had dreamed once about Christ's feet, not his crucifixion or his resurrection or his sacred heart, but his feet. The scent,
emanating from the church floor, even God's feet in his dream, made him think more highly of religion somehow. The other monks, Sebastian, for instance, would have impugned the build-up in the floor crevices as profane. But Thomas lay there, knowing suddenly that what he smelled was a fine patina of the most inviolate beauty, and shockingly holy. He was smelling the earth. He'd been at St. Sennar Abbey on the small South Carolina island for nearly 5 years, each one of those years a bone of darkness that he'd gnawed. And still no marrow of light, he thought, though now and then he felt an occasional beam of it dart out of nowhere and hit him, just as it had a moment ago when he'd caught that scent. After his other life had ended, the one with his wife and his unborn child, he'd been incurably driven. Sometimes his quest seemed impossible, like an eye trying to look back and see its own self. All he'd discerned so far was that God seemed surreptitiously about and wrenchingly ordinary. That was all. His real name was Whit O'Connor. Before, in that other life, he'd been an attorney in Raleigh, thwarting developers and industrial polluters on behalf of various conservation and environmental groups. There had been a brick house with a landscaped yard, and his wife, Linda, 7.5 months pregnant. She'd worked as an office manager in an orthodontist practice. But she'd wanted to stay home and raise their child, even though that wasn't fashionable. He'd liked that about her, that she wasn't fashionable. They'd met at Duke, gotten married the Sunday afternoon following her graduation in her family's tiny Methodist church near Flat Rock, North Carolina. And they'd never been apart, until the tire came off the truck in front of her car on I-77. The medic who'd responded to the accident told him over and over that she had gone quickly, as if her leaving sooner would console him. His sense of abandonment had been bottomless, not just by Linda and the promise of family, but by God, whom he'd actually believed in, the kind of believing one does before immense suffering. Linda had called him from work the day she died to tell him she was sure they were having a girl. Up until then, she'd had no feeling either way, though he personally had believed all along it was a boy. The impression had come over her while standing in the shower that morning. She'd touched her abdomen and simply known. He smiled now, remembering this, and his lips brushed against the floor. After the funeral, he'd learned from the coroner that she'd been right. He couldn't remember precisely when it had first occurred to him to come here, but it had been around a year after her death. He'd sent his baptism and confirmation records, recommendations from 2 priests, and a long, carefully constructed letter. And still everyone, including the abbot, had said he was running away from his grief. They'd had no idea what they were talking about. He'd cradled his grief, almost to the point of loving it. For so long he'd refused to give it up, because leaving it behind was like leaving her. Sometimes he couldn't fathom why he'd thrown in his lot with these aging men. Some were grumpy to the point he went out of his way to avoid them, and at least 4 inched about with walkers and lived permanently in the infirmary. There was one monk, Brother Fabian, who was always writing letters of complaint to the Pope about things the rest of them did, and posting copies in the corridors. Brother Basil had a bizarre tic, shouting out, "Meep!" during choir or other odd sacrosanct moments. Meep. What did it mean? It had driven Thomas nuts at first, but Basil was at least kind, unlike Sebastian. Thomas had not been one of those people who romanticized monasteries, and if he had, that illusion would have evaporated the first week. Simply, his grieving had opened into a larger abyss. "I have come here not to find answers," he'd written in his notebook that first year, "but to find a way to live in a world without any." To be honest, He'd been turned away 3 times over the course of 3 years before the abbot, Dom Anthony, finally accepted him. Thomas was sure it was not because the abbot had changed his mind, but because he'd finally worn him down. Because, too, they'd needed a younger man, someone who could climb the ladder into the timber buttresses of the church and change the light bulbs, who knew about computers, that the word reboot did not necessarily mean putting on your shoes again, as several monks seemed to think. Mostly they'd needed someone who could take their small boat into the creeks and measure egret eggs, count hatchlings, and test the water for salinity. Work the monastery had been contracted to do for the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources to bring in extra income. Thomas was happy to do it. He loved disappearing into the rookery. His arms had begun to ache a little around the elbows. He changed position and turned his head in the other direction. He saw the church as a mouse would see it, as a beetle. He rolled his eyes toward the ceiling without moving his head and felt he was lying at the bottom of the world, looking up. The place where all ladders start. Wasn't that what Yeats had said? He had spent a lot of his time here reading, especially the poets, systematically going through the volumes in the library. He loved Yeats best. He felt less consequential down here on the floor, and it struck him that all self-important people, the ones in Congress, in the Vatican, at AT&T, perhaps, should lie down here for a while. They should lie here and look up and see how different everything seemed. He'd had an overly important sense of himself before coming here. He admitted it. The cases he tried, so many of them high profile, had often put him on the front page of state newspapers, and sometimes he still thought about that life with nostalgia. He remembered the time he'd prevented a big landfill company from trucking in sewage sludge from New York City, how it had landed him in the New York Times, and then all the television interviews he'd given. He'd basked in that. On the boat, the day he'd come here to stay, he'd thought of the River Styx, of the ferryman ushering him across the last threshold. He'd imagined he was dying to his old life and coming ashore to a new one, one hidden out here in the water, hidden from the world. It was silly and overly dramatic, but he'd liked the analogy. Then it had turned out that it wasn't so much the water, but the trees that had impressed him. How the branches were warped and curled in extravagant spirals from the ocean winds. The moment he'd seen them, he'd known that it was a place of harshness, of enduring. Of course, he'd taken the name Brother Thomas because he was the resident doubter, and it was practically a cliché, but he took it anyway. He doubted God. Perhaps he would find there had never been a God. Or he would lose one God and find another. He didn't know. Despite this, he felt God the same way the arthritic monks felt rain coming in their joints. He felt only the hint of him. On the first page of the notebook, he'd written, "Disputed Questions," in honor of Thomas Merton, the monk who'd written a book by that title. He'd pointed this out to Dom Anthony as some sort of defense, but it had not saved him. If you were going to be heretical and get away with it, you needed to be dead long enough for people to get over the heresy and rediscover you. He tried to recall the most damning parts of the notebook. Probably the questions that woke him in the night. He'd sat with his window open, listening to the buoys out on Bull's Bay making their sonorous music, and he'd written them all down. Questions about evil and whether it could exist without God's collusion. About Nietzsche's claim that God is dead. Even theories that God is not a being in heaven, but merely some guiding aspect in the human personality. He felt a rush of dismay at the thought of the abbot's reading this. He wanted to get up and find him, to explain. But what would he say? The wind rose outside, sweeping in from the bay, flapping over the roof. He imagined it tearing the surface of the water. The monastery bell clanged, calling the monks to sleep, telling them the great silence was beginning. And he wondered if the abbot had forgotten about him. The church had filled up with shadows, the long slits of pale glass in the windows completely dark. He thought of the chapel behind the chancel, where the mermaid chair sat on a carpeted dais. He liked to go and sit in the chair sometimes, when no tourists were around. He always wondered why Sanara, their famous little saint, had been carved on the chair in her mermaid form, a half-nude mermaid at that. He didn't object to the portrayal, he rather appreciated it. It was just so unlike the Benedictines to highlight her breasts. From the moment he'd seen the mermaid chair, he'd loved Sanara, not just her mythic life in the sea, but for how supposedly she'd heard the prayers of Egret Islanders and saved them, not only from hurricanes, but from golf courses. In the beginning, he'd sat in the mermaid chair and thought of his wife, of making love to her. Now he could go weeks and not think of her. Sometimes when he thought of making love, it was simply with a woman, a generic woman, not Linda at all. Back when he'd arrived as a postulant, it had not been hard to give up sex. He did not see then how he could make love to anyone but Linda. Her hair spread across the pillow. The smell of her, that was gone. Sex was gone. He'd let it go. He felt a tightening at his groin. How ridiculous to think sex would stay away. Things would hide out in an underground place for a while. They would sink like the little weights they tied on their cast nets, but they wouldn't stay down there forever. Everything that goes down comes up. And then he almost laughed at the pun he'd made without intending to. The past few months, he'd thought of sex too much. Doing without had become an actual sacrifice, but it didn't make him feel holy, only denied. More of a normal monk chafing at celibacy. In June, he would take his last vows, and that would be that. When the footsteps came at last, he closed his eyes, then opened them again when the sound stopped. He saw the toes of a pair of shoes, Reeboks, and the hem of a robe brushing against them. The abbot spoke in his Irish brogue, not one bit of it flaked away after all these years. I hope it was productive time. Yes, Reverend Father. Not too harsh, then. No, Reverend Father. Thomas didn't know how old Dom Anthony was, but he looked ancient, gazing down. The skin of his face drooping from his chin, and cheeks almost like ruffles. Sometimes the things he said sprang from such a timeless old world. Once, during a Sunday morning chapter meeting, sitting on his throne-like chair holding his crozier, he'd said, "The same time St. Patrick drove the snakes from Ireland, he changed all the old pagan women into mermaids." Thomas had thought that quaint and a little bizarre. Could the abbot really believe that? "Go to bed now," Dom Anthony said. Thomas lifted himself from the floor and walked out of the church into a night that was heaving about in the wind. He flipped his cowl over his head and crossed the central cloister, headed toward the duplex cottages scattered under the world oaks near the marsh. He followed the path toward the cottage he shared with Father Dominic. Dominic was the abbey librarian and also the monastery prankster. "Every court has its jester," Dominic liked to say. He had aspirations of being a writer and kept Thomas up nights with his typing. Thomas had no idea what Dominic was working on the other side of the cottage, but he had a feeling it might be a murder mystery, an Irish abbot who turns up dead in the refectory, strangled with his own rosary, something like that. The path was lined with cement plaques announcing the stations of the cross, and Thomas moved past them through spiky bits of fog that had blown in from the ocean, thinking now of Dominic, who'd once drawn smiley faces on several of them. Of course, Dom Anthony had made him scrub the plaques and then the choir stalls, while the rest of them got to watch The Sound of Music on television. Why couldn't he get into trouble the way Dominic did, for something droll and comic? Why did it have to be for the existential bullshit he wrote in his notebook? He'd thought for a while he might get into trouble over the baseball card that he used to mark pages in his prayer book, but apparently no one, including the abbot, seemed to care. It surprised Thomas, how much he missed simple things like baseball. Once in a while he got to watch a game on television, but it wasn't the same. Dale Murphy had hit 44 home runs last year, and he'd seen only one of them. Linda had given him the baseball card their last Christmas together. Eddie Matthews, 1953. There was no telling what she'd paid for it. He envied Dominic, who had to be 80 at least and went about in a tattered straw hat everywhere except choir. He'd been the one who'd convinced the abbot to put a television in the music listening room. Once, Dominic had tapped on Thomas's door after the great silence and tried to convince him to sneak over and watch a special program about shooting the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. Thomas had not gone. He regretted it to this day. He was nearly at his cottage when he stopped abruptly, thinking he heard a voice. A woman's voice calling in the distance. He looked east toward the rookery, his robe beating around his legs. A whippoorwill sang out. The gullah woman on the island, Hepzibah Postel, the one who kept up the slave cemetery, had told him once that whippoorwills were the departed spirits of loved ones. Of course he didn't believe this, and he was pretty sure she didn't either, but he liked to think it was Linda out there, singing, that it was her voice calling in the distance. Thomas pictured his wife, or was it merely the generic woman, posing in a swimsuit. He imagined the place inside her thigh, just above her knees, the softness there. He thought about kissing that place. He stood beneath a bent tree in the great silence, and he thought about falling into life, and then about flying far above it. Then he heard it again, a woman's voice calling out. Not a bird singing, or the wind moaning, but a woman. Chapter 7. The smell of gumbo hung inside the house in thick green ropes, like something you could swing on to get across the kitchen. I set my suitcase on the beige rug and walked down the hallway to Mother's bedroom. I called out, Mother? It's me, Jessie. And my voice sounded grainy and tired. She was not in her bed. The blanket was thrown back and the white sheets were wadded up in a mess, as if children had gone berserk jumping up and down on them. The bathroom door was shut, and fluorescent light leaked out from the bottom edge. As I waited for her to come out, I stretched my achy shoulders and neck. A pair of worn-out terry cloth slippers had been tossed upside down on the rug, which was beige like its sibling in the living room. Mother did not believe in unbeige rugs, or in walls or curtains in any color other than white, cream, and ivory. She did believe in green paint outside, but inside things had to be more or less the color of tap water. The color of a life bled completely out. I regarded the old-fashioned dressing table with the gathered skirt. Was it beige or was it white with a case of old age? In the center of the dresser, Mother's ceramic Madonna had a chubby Jesus hoisted onto her hip and a look of postpartum depression about her. Beside it was a photograph of my father on his boat. The water was navy blue and traveled behind him forever. I was not thinking about how noiseless Mother was behind the bathroom door. I was preoccupied with the sense of wading back into her life. Into this room, swimming in the contradictions she always stirred in me, the tangle of love and loathing. I scanned the bedside table, her old red-beaded rosary, two prescription bottles, a roll of gauze, tape, scissors, a digital clock. I realized I was looking for the mayonnaise jar. It was nowhere in the room. Mother? I tapped on the bathroom door. Silence loomed back, and then a thin, sticky anxiety seeped from behind the door. I turned the knob and stepped inside. There was nothing but the minuscule bathroom. Empty. I walked into the kitchen, a room so changeless it seemed magically frozen in place. Entering it was like strolling back into the 1950s. The same can opener attached to the wall, the canisters with the rooster motif, copper tea kettle, tin bread box, dingy teaspoons mounted on a wooden rack. The wall clock beside the refrigerator was a black cat with a swinging tail pendulum. The immortal Felix. I expected to see Mother sitting at the formica table eating gumbo. But this room, too, was empty. I hurried through the dining room, checked the two extra bedrooms, Mike's and my old rooms. She had to have been here while Hepzibah was in the house. What, 10 minutes ago? I returned to the kitchen and looked up Hepzibah's number, but as I reached for the phone, I noticed the back door ajar. Grabbing a flashlight, I stepped onto the back stairs, swinging the beam across the yard. The sash to Mother's blue bathrobe lay in a coil on the bottom step. I went down and retrieved it. The wind had picked up. It took the sash right out of my hand. I watched it jerk and flail into the darkness. Where would she go? I remembered the time Dee, 5 years old, had slipped away from me in North Lake Mall, the seizure of panic I'd felt, followed by an almost preternatural calm, by some voice inside telling me the only way to find Dee was to think like her. I'd sat on a bench and thought like Dee, then walked straight to the children's shoe store, where I'd found her among the Sesame Street tennis shoes, trying to lace Bert and Ernie onto her small feet. I knew only one thing Mother loved the way Dee had loved Bert and Ernie. I found the path that led to the monastery at the back of the yard. It wasn't a long path, but it twisted through overarching wax myrtle and sweet bay and snags of dewberry vines. The monks had cut a crude opening for Mother in the monastery wall, so she wouldn't have to go all the way around to the entrance when she came to cook for them. They called it Nell's Gate. Mother, of course, ate that up. She'd told me about it at least 50 times. As I stepped through it, I shouted her name. I heard an animal of some sort rustle in the brush, then a whippoorwill, and when the wind died momentarily, the distant pitch and tumble of the ocean, that endless percussion it makes. Mother had worn a foot trail to the main path that ran between the cloister and the monks' cottages. I followed it, pausing once or twice to call out to her. But the wind seemed to bat my voice right back at me. The moon had risen. It hung low out over the marsh, a startling orb of glassy light. When I saw the back of the cloister enclave, I cut off the flashlight and began to run. Everything flowed past me, the little markers with the stations of the cross, the plumes of mist, the sea wind, and the knotty ground. I swept past the stucco house where the monks made their nets, the sign over its door reading, Fortuna, Maria, Retia Nostra. Bless Mary, our nets. The statue of St. Sinara was in an enclosed garden beside the church. I stepped through the gate into a dense haven of rose bushes, their limbs bare and reaching, forming candelabra shadows against the far wall. The monks had designed the garden with St. Sinara's statue in the center, and 6 evenly spaced paths leading into her. She looked like the hub of a magnificent floral wheel. I'd played here as a child. While Mother slaved in the monastery kitchen, I would come out here and pull dozens of rose heads off their stems, filling a sweet grass basket with petals, a whole mishmash of colors, which I disposed of in secret ceremonies, tossing them into the marsh behind the church, around the trunks of certain venerable bearded oaks, and onto the seat of the mermaid chair, for some reason that being the most honored spot. It was my funeral game, a solemn play I'd indulged in after my father died. The petals were his ashes, and I'd thought what I was doing was saying goodbye. But it may have been just the opposite, that I was trying to hold on to him, tuck him in private places only I knew. I would find the petals weeks later, lumps of brown, dried rose chips. The night seemed paler now, as if the wind had blown some of the darkness out of it. I stood still, letting my eyes roam across the tops of the rose bushes, along the paths plowed with moonlight. There was no sign of my mother. I wish then I'd called Hepzibah and Cat instead of dashing over here, wasting all this time. I'd just been so sure she would be here. Much surer than I'd been about Dee and the shoe store. Mother had made herself the keeper of the statue about the same time she'd started work in the kitchen. She often trudged out here with a bucket of soapy water to wash the bird shit off it, and 4 times a year she waxed it with a paste that smelled like orange peel and limes. She came here to pour out the various and sundry torments of her life, instead of going into the church and telling them to God. Sanara was practically a nobody in the hierarchical world of saints, but Mother believed in her. She loved to recount the story of my birth as proof of Sanara's potency, how I was turned backward in her womb and became stuck during the delivery. She'd prayed to Sanara, who'd promptly flipped me upside down, and I'd wriggled head first into the world. Out here in the middle of the garden, the statue appeared like a stamen protruding from the center of a huge, winter-blighted flower. It occurred to me that the saint had presided the same way over my childhood, her shadow hovering above the emptiness that had come when I was 9. The worst punishment Mike and I ever received had come because we dressed the statue in a 2-piece swimsuit, sunglasses, and a blonde wig. We'd cut the bottom of the suit in half and pinned it together around Sonara's hips. Some monks had thought the getup was funny, but Mother had cried over our disrespect